The next matter, number 25-2207, Ecolab Incorporated et al. Versus IBA Incorporated et al. At this time, would counsel for the appellants please come to the podium and introduce herself on the record to begin?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Rachel Scobie for Appellants Ecolab, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
You may.
The doctrine of claim splitting does not apply here. Designed to protect judicial economy, consistency, and defendants from truly repetitive litigation, it was never meant to be a merits immunity doctrine that makes a distinct, never adjudicated claim untriable in any forum. But that's exactly what the district court's dismissal does here. It eliminates claims that the Minnesota court has held are not part of, and more importantly, not even relevant to, the claims that are pending there, and it grants immunity to Webco, a party who cannot even be sued in Minnesota. The Minnesota and Massachusetts claims address different wrongs to be proved by different evidence. Minnesota concerns IBA's continued manufacture and sale of Ecolab products and an alleged non-compete violation. Massachusetts, in contrast, concerns IBA's and Webco's alleged use of Ecolab's trade secrets to develop a new IBA product line, claims that did not even arise until after Ecolab filed suit in Minnesota. Bringing these separate claims in separate cases is not claim splitting. And these cases are in separate courts because of appellees' own choices. IBA convinced the Minnesota court that the trade secret claims addressed to the IBA product line were materially different from the claims pending there and therefore could not even be the subject of discovery in
that
case.
But you could have brought those claims, at least as against, for right now, we'll talk about IBA because I know there's different issues with relation to Webco, but the district court in Minnesota is saying that the claims aren't part of that litigation is different from saying that they couldn't have been, right? And so I don't think that the fact that the court disregarded or disallowed discovery necessarily answers the question. It drives us instead to the question of could the claims have been brought? And so that brings us to the timing issue of did you have adequate notice of the claims at the time of filing? Which brings us then, I think, to a subsequent question is, the amended complaint or the original complaint? Because it strikes me that if you're looking at the amended complaint, you have a difficult time, I think, arguing that you didn't have notice of these potential claims. But tell me if I'm wrong about how much notice you had as of the time of the amended complaint.
So there certainly are facts that were learned after the time of the amended complaint. I mean, significantly in this record, there's evidence of an email being sent to the Webco engineer who allegedly developed the IBA product line in November of 2021, just before they started their development of this new product line. So there certainly are facts that were learned after the amended complaint. That email was produced, well, that part's not in the record. But anyway, that information was not available as of the time of the amended complaint. I will say I do think that the proper time for considering this issue is at the time of the initial complaint or consideration of claims that were actually asserted in the actual amended complaint. And that comes out of the Aspects Eyewear case, which we've cited in our brief, which says that claims that could have been brought for res judicata purposes means claims in existence at the time the original complaint was filed or claims that were, quote, actually asserted in a supplemental pleading. And here, to the extent Ecolab wanted to claim that its supplemental pleading actually asserted claims against the IBA products, the Minnesota court has said very clearly that that is not the case, and they did that at IBA's insistence. So IBA, if it had wanted to confront claims related to the IBA products in one case in Minnesota, could have allowed Ecolab's argument that those claims should be considered fairly within the scope of the amended complaint there. They objected to that. They fought that. They succeeded in fighting that and convincing the Minnesota court that those claims were not part of those claims of the amended of what was pled in the amended complaint. They succeeded in shutting down any discovery related to the development of the IBA claims in that case on the argument that it was not relevant. And frankly, that's, I think, important because if you look at the restatement second of judgments where it talks about sort of the modern res judicata framework and how it has expanded from what used to be a very narrow application only to claims that were actually pleaded. One of the reasons it says it has broadened and expanded is because of the breadth of discovery that is allowed now in federal courts. Well, IBA and the Minnesota court said these claims are not part of this amended complaint, and in fact, so unrelated to the claims that are pleaded there, you can't even get discovery on it here. So,
counsel, let me ask you, even if we do look at the original complaint, didn't you, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because the record is a bit confusing on the timeline, but my understanding is that at least one, there's five products that ultimately might be an issue here, and that at least one of the five products had already been on the market, and it, and again, I don't know exact timeline, but maybe a few days before you filed the initial complaint, there was more information coming to you, to your client, of course, that there are products, additional products that were being developed, and then I think they got quickly sent for testing to someone that worked for your client. So why didn't you know about these claims? Why couldn't you have asserted these claims even at the time of the original complaint?
So the evidence in the record shows Ecolab becoming aware that the ProSan product, that's one of, I think there's four that are specifically, four IBA products specifically named in the Massachusetts complaint. ProSan was the first one. There's an email from February 17th, 2022, I believe. Apologies. February 17th, saying that Ecolab became aware that the product was in the marketplace. That's it. Nothing about development of it, who made it. For remember, IBA is a party that sells products made by other parties. So at the time Ecolab became aware of the presence of the ProSan product in the marketplace, it had a claim for breach of the non-compete, because that's what the non-compete claim goes to, is the fact that they were not supposed to be selling competing ASC TTIP products for a period of a year after termination of the agreement under Ecolab's 3 of the case. In that case, we learned of the product 6 days before we filed the complaint alleging the non-compete claim because of the presence in the market. The record also shows that Ecolab did not even get a sample of that product until March 4th, about 2 weeks after the complaint was filed. So at the time Ecolab filed the original complaint in this case, it absolutely did not have any basis to assert a claim for trade secret misappropriation as to the ProSan case.
Are there marketing claims as to the IBA products in the Minnesota action?
So the Minnesota action address has a claim for breach of an alleged non-compete. And that is a breach of contract claim that is in the Minnesota action. And the breach of the non-compete was triggered by IBA offering competitive ASC TTIP products. Those are the products that IBA and Webco developed using Ecolab's trade secrets and then began selling. But the Minnesota case, as the Minnesota court held, has absolutely no component to it that addresses that later learned misappropriation of trade secrets in the development of the formula and manufacturing methods to make the products. The Minnesota case addresses the fact of them offering them for sale in breach of the non-compete.
So your understanding of the record is that as of the time you filed the complaint, the only thing your client knew was that one of the products was on the market.
Correct.
But had no idea who had developed it.
At that time, no. That was later learned. And then the other three products, there is no evidence that Ecolab knew anything about their existence or offering. One of them was offered, I believe, about a week before the complaint was filed in Minnesota. But again, there's no evidence that Ecolab knew that that other product had been offered. And then the other two products were not even offered until March of 2022 after the complaint had been filed. So,
and one other question, I understand this is relevant if the date of the amended complaint is relevant as opposed to the initial complaint, but why didn't you move to amend the complaint in the Minnesota case, especially if you were gathering facts within weeks of when the initial complaint was filed? Why didn't your client just amend and put all of these claims into that action?
So, Your Honor, I think the record is that Ecolab did take the position that these claims were covered within the scope of the amended complaint. IBA argued otherwise, and the Minnesota court held that IBA's position on that was correct, that the amended pleading that had been submitted there was too broad in how it phrased the accused products to be read to encompass the new IBA products. But the record in Minnesota shows that we, in fact, believed and told the court we believed that we were accusing the new IBA products in that amended complaint. We were told that was not correct, that the court did not interpret the complaint that way. IBA advocated for that result, and they obtained it. And that's fair. We'll live with that determination. From a timing perspective, if the next question was going to be, well, why didn't you then amend it again? Well, because in the meantime, Webco had fought personal jurisdiction as a result of that amended complaint being filed. Webco had prevailed in getting the court to dismiss it and find that there was no personal jurisdiction over it in Minnesota. And so now Ecolab, confronted with the court saying, your claims for trade secret misappropriation of the IBA products are not part of this case, and you can't sue Webco, who you believe was intimately involved in that misconduct here, did the exact logical thing that, in fact, what the court in ruling on the personal jurisdiction motion invited Ecolab to do, which was file the suit in a place where it could obtain personal jurisdiction over Webco and IBA. And that's what Ecolab did here. These cases are not in two separate courts because Ecolab wanted them to be. If you look at the court's claim splitting cases, they all involve fact patterns where the plaintiff is trying to game the system, right? They lost a first case, so now they're trying again with a different cause of action. They lost a first case in state court, now they're trying again in federal court. Or they're trying to bring claims in series so that they can maximize their recovery. That is not what happened here. And before I run out of time, I do want to say the issues are different. There are three independent bases.
Before you get to that, counsel, I just want to make sure I understood one point that I thought you made. I want to make sure I understood it correctly. Your client would have further amended had Webco not been dismissed?
That would certainly have been a much more logical choice. We were not confronted with those facts at the time that...
Oh, I thought you said that they would have further amended. That's not what you were meaning to say.
Apologies. What I meant to say is we didn't further amend in Minnesota because in the meantime, we had learned we couldn't sue Webco there, so it made no sense to keep this one case about misappropriation of the trade secrets and the development of the IBA products against two different joint tortfeasors in two separate cases. The more logical decision was to file in Massachusetts, where this whole issue of misappropriation in connection with the IBA products could be tried against both of those defendants together. But I do want to just very quickly, if I may, Your Honor.
I think you have 3 minutes for rebuttal, right?
Okay, as long as I can address the separate issue of Webco.
Yes.
Okay,
we'll give you time.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would counsel for Appley IBA please introduce himself on the record to begin?
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Bob Gilbertson from the Forsgren Fisher firm, appearing for IBA. May it please the court. I'd like to draw the court's attention in my time with you, and if it's acceptable to the court, we've arranged between the two of us, counsel for IBA and counsel for Webco, that I would get up to 10 minutes and that counsel for Webco would get whatever I don't use. Is that okay with the court?
Yes, I think it's 10-5 is the split. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. I'd like to talk about the amendment issue that has already been the subject of some conversation. I would like to also talk a bit about the standard of review and the decision that the district court made. Of course, my main goal would be to address any questions Your Honors have. But I'd like to go forward or pick up from one of the moments that was just discussed in the colloquy with Ecolab's counsel. And that had to do with this, the way this issue came before the Minnesota courts. There was an amended complaint that was filed in 2023. And after that, there was a dispute about discovery. about whether Ecolab should be able to get discovery about our chemical formulations and our development of our TTIP products. And in the course of arguing, and we took the position that claims about that weren't part of what had been pled. And Ecolab argued repeatedly and vigorously that they were. Ecolab has repeatedly and vigorously told courts that its claims that are now before this court in the context of the Massachusetts action were in the case. They must have known about them if Ecolab thought they were in the case, as of the time, at least, of the amended complaint. But then when the motion to compel was decided by the Minnesota courts, decided by the magistrate judge first, and then on appeal to the Article III judge, Ecolab again took that same position that those claims as to our development and chemistry were part of the case, but then also said to the court at page, I believe it's 596, 597 of their brief to Judge Tostrud, that the court should, to the extent the court does not sustain Ecolab's objection, it should grant Ecolab leave to file a second amended complaint. The brief discusses the standards for such a motion and says denying leave to amend would create inefficiencies. So clearly, Ecolab's decision to, well, and then what the court did, as your honors no doubt know, is denied that request because it failed to comply with the local rule and how you present a motion for leave to amend. But it denied the request without prejudice, essentially inviting Ecolab to come to the court with a motion. Ecolab made the strategic choice, one of several strategic choices that we believe this court should require it to live with, made the strategic choice to come to Massachusetts instead of going back to that court and asking for leave to amend and doing so based on the local rule.
On the timeline, counsel, by that time, had the Minnesota court decided there was no personal jurisdiction over Webco?
I believe the answer to that is yes, but I would have to check and make certain about that.
Okay.
I believe that had happened some months before that request that I just spoke about. This court, in many decisions, Hatch for sure, Airframe, has held parties to their strategic choices. That was a choice that Ecolab made in this case. And it's similar to a choice that was made in the Hatch case, where there was a motion to amend that was denied, and the plaintiff in that case decided not to appeal that denial, but to bring a separate action. And this court in Hatch said, you don't get a second opportunity if you've had the opportunity to go forward in the first case where you thought the claims could be brought. You don't get a second opportunity to come and file a new complaint and bring those claims separately. Airframe was a similar situation, but different in an important respect. In Airframe, in the first case, the court had invited the plaintiff to submit a letter explaining why its complaint shouldn't be dismissed. And in the letter that the plaintiff submitted, the plaintiffs offered to submit an amended complaint. The court didn't explicitly rule on that, but did grant the motion to dismiss, which that plaintiff could have appealed, but chose not to. Same result took place in this court, that you can't make the strategic choice to forego a challenge to the thing you lost in the first case and get it back by going to another court.
Can we talk a little bit about the timeline and your view of what Ecolab had available to it at the time of the initial complaint? And I understand you argue we should look at the amended complaint. But I'm interested in that first. What was known then and why that would be enough?
Be glad to, Your Honor. If you would indulge me, if I could just finish one thought from the last point that I wanted to note. I suggest that it would be a very odd legal approach to say, as the court has in Hatch and Airframe, that if you decide not to appeal from the denial of motion to amend or the implicit denial of a motion to amend in the first case, you can't get a separate opportunity in a new lawsuit, but you can if you chose not to if you chose not to bring the motion. Here, Ecolab specifically asked the court. It did so in violation of a local rule, but it did specifically ask the court. But let me address directly Your Honor's question. Yeah, at the time of the original complaint, as you can see from the complaint itself, Ecolab certainly knew about the license agreement that governed the parties' relationships, certainly knew about facts that it believed constituted a breach of that agreement, certainly knew about what it believed were its trade secrets, and certainly knew about facts that it believed constituted a misappropriation of those trade secrets. All of that is in the original complaint itself. You can see in that complaint at paragraph 27, which is on page 153 of the joint appendix, recently Ecolab learned that IBA was acting in violation of the terms of the license agreement by marketing non-covered products, meaning not Ecolab products. That's in the complaint itself. At paragraph 39 on page 154 of the joint appendix, IBA breached the license agreement by marketing a non-covered product. That's a reference to one non-Ecolab product called UltraGuard that they had found was being sold in Arizona outside of the region that had been agreed.
I think your opposing counsel might say that doesn't necessarily relate to the development of those products. Does that make a difference?
Well, so we agree that they didn't plead that a claim based on the development of those products, but with the knowledge that they had, some of which I've just recounted, another piece of which was the email from distributed within Ecolab a week before the original complaint saying IBA is selling ProSan, which is a second non-Ecolab product, and is taking herds away from Ecolab's product. So they knew all that. And under Maripis and other case law from this circuit, that put Ecolab on inquiry notice. They had the information, all of the information that they would need to investigate that claim. They had plenty of time within the scheduling order in the Minnesota case to put that before the court. When the court decided they hadn't done that, Ecolab then had the opportunity to challenge that decision with a formal motion and perhaps with an appeal. They still have, depending on how the Minnesota case comes out, the right to appeal that decision. If I may, with my minute left, I would like to address the topic of standard of review. I know that both sides believe that they win under either standard, but it can be an important part of an appeal, obviously. In this court's case 4 years ago in Maldonado Cabrera, the way the court put it at the beginning of its analysis was, as part of its general power to administer its docket, a district court may stay or dismiss a suit that is duplicative of another federal court suit. And that was done in the context of the prior pending action doctrine, which is not the same thing as claim splitting, but does get at the same kinds of issues, the issues associated with trying to avoid duplicative litigation, avoid the chance of inconsistent results, look out for resources in judicial economy, try to discourage forum shopping, and try to protect parties against what one case called the vexation of concurrent litigation over the same cases. This was an example of the district court managing its docket under that inherent power. It used the tests that the First Circuit has dictated. It applied them in a way that Ecolab challenges. That's an abuse of discretion case.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would counsel for Appley Webco please introduce herself on the record to begin?
Good afternoon, Christine Bush, on behalf of Appley Webco Chemical. And before I start, I just want to make it clear that we join in IBA's arguments, and I'm going to make an effort not to repeat what IBA just presented to the court. Instead, I'm going to try to focus on three issues that I think may come up. I understand Ecolab reserved on the Webco argument, so I'm a little bit on the back of my heels at guessing at what council is going to try to advocate, but I have some ideas to where I think that council may go with respect to Ecolab. First, I anticipate that Ecolab is going to argue that Webco waived its inclusion in this argument, and or that the district court somehow sua sponte entered this order to dismiss and applied it to Webco, and neither is accurate. First of all, a sua sponte dismissal, I apologize for the cold. A sua sponte dismissal is only when a district court dismisses on its own initiative. Here, both defendants filed motions to dismiss all claims of the complaint. And that was clear from docket number 30 from IBA.
But did you raise claim splitting?
Webco did not. And we were clear about that in our briefing to this court, page 17. We did not take the lead on that.
So doesn't that matter, though? I mean, you move to dismiss, but there are different issues that are implicated as to Webco, privity of parties and the like. So why is it not sua sponte simply because you filed a motion to dismiss, but a motion to dismiss that didn't raise this issue?
It's not sua sponte for at least three reasons. May I grab something really quickly, please? First of all, like I said, Webco moved to dismiss all the claims in the complaint, and counts 1, 2, and 3 are with respect to Webco and IBA. The claims against them in those counts are the same. Second of all, it was actually Ecolab itself that raised the specter of Webco in its briefing. In its opposition brief to the IBA motion to dismiss, it's Ecolab itself that raised the issue of Webco. And in this, and in the reply and the surreply, Webco came up. And so the whole point of the prohibition against a sua sponte dismissal is because there's an argument that there was no notice, no opportunity to be heard. Ecolab raised Webco.
But raised Webco in what way?
Raised Webco in the context of the second prong of claim splitting. Are these parties sufficiently related? Now, Ecolab was arguing essentially that there had to be privity, which is not accurate under Hatch or San Juan Hotel, or that they had to be identical. Also not true.
But counsel, isn't the issue still that normally they should have had the benefit of responding to a developed argument from you on this issue and how it specifically applied to your client versus IBA? And they didn't have that. And as you said, the whole point of the rule really is about notice and making sure that it's a fair process to both sides. And you didn't move on that ground. It's a very different ground from a 12B6 ground, you know, on the merits. So why isn't the purpose of the rule the sua sponte, the prohibition or, you know, disfavor for sua sponte dismissal? Why doesn't it apply here? Because they didn't really get a fair shake, in their view, at being able to respond to the arguments about your client in particular.
And I understand that they make the point that they didn't make a fair shake, but they did respond to that second prong of the analysis. And I presume that they would have responded the exact same way. Even if Webco had said, oh yes, me too, we join in that, Ecolab still would have made the arguments that it made, i.e. the parties are not identical, they're not in privity, and they're not substantially related, which are the same arguments that the court has seen on appeal. And so Ecolab itself had plenty of notice that as part of the two-prong analysis, the court, the district court, any court, has to look at who was the defendant in the first action and who are the defendants in the second. Webco was always wrapped up into that analysis, and the district court did it correctly. And there's ample precedent, which we cited in our brief, that the district court can apply an analysis to other defendants who haven't necessarily raised it expressly. And that's what the district court did here appropriately. The analysis is the same whether Webco said me too or not. Are Webco and IBA related for the purposes of the First Circuit precedent? And here the answer is yes, under San Juan Hotel, because in each of
In Real San Juan seems a little bit different. As I recall, there was an attorney-client relationship, correct me if I'm wrong. So there's a tight agency relationship. Here you have two independent companies, yes, both involved in some way, the manufacture and sale in different ways, but through arm's length interaction. So it seems to me that case might not be squarely on point, but let me know if you think I'm wrong on that.
I respectfully disagree with you, Your Honor, and the reason is because of how Ecolab pled these two parties intertwined. It does not have to be a fiduciary relationship, although in that instance there was the relationship that the court just alluded to. But here the problem is, or the situation that Ecolab set up, is that by pleading that Webco is liable for DTS, for trade secret misappropriation, because of a license agreement it never signed, it lashes Webco to IBA. Ecolab's manner of pleading created the situation. And to be clear, before I go any further, we are not seeking joint, we're not arguing that the rule should be expanded to all joint tortfeasors. That's not what we're arguing. This is a very narrow situation with how Ecolab pled in both cases that this license agreement, to which my client is not a party, imbues my client with the responsibility of understanding and keeping protected certain confidential information. It is that transactional contract-based relationship that goes across both cases that links it together here.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. At this time, would counsel for the appellant please reintroduce herself on the record? She has a 3-minute rebuttal.
Thank you, Rachel Scobie, for appellants, Your Honors. Very briefly, counsel for IBA mentioned a product, UltraGuard. I just want to be very clear. The UltraGuard product in the Minnesota case was an IBA product that was actually part of the party's contract agreement. It is an issue in the Minnesota case. It is not an accused product in Massachusetts, so it is not relevant to the claim splitting issue here. With respect to Merapacy, that case was cited. That is a completely different fact pattern. In Merapacy, there's no question that the wrong was committed when the chemical was applied to the person's hands. The person had a rash right away, and publicly available information could have informed them that this is a carcinogen and therefore could have brought the claim for being exposed to a carcinogen again at the same time. We're not talking in the case between Minnesota claims and Massachusetts claims. These aren't extra injuries from the same wrong. These are completely different wrongs. Breaching a contract, breaching a non-compete are completely different from using trade secrets of another party to develop your own line of products that is, time will tell exactly how identical to what the trade secret products, what the trade secrets taught. But I want to talk a little bit about the Webco issue. I think there's two key points to make here. Number one, no party brought a motion as to Webco. Webco keeps saying it didn't move to dismiss itself on claim splitting. Neither did IBA. IBA's claim splitting motion specifically asked the court to dismiss the claims on claim splitting grounds as to IBA, not as to Webco. No one moved to dismiss as to Webco. And at the oral argument on the motion, IBA's counsel told the court, Webco's not making this motion. Only IBA is. And in the Minnesota court, IBA and Webco convinced the Minnesota court that they were completely separate in function and ownership, with no overlap in owners, employees, executives, or directors, that IBA has no involvement in Webco's finances or business logistics, and has no control over their technical manufacturing work, mixing, testing, or quality control. This is a manufacturer and a distributor. They are joint tortfeasors, but that is as far as their relationship goes, and that is not enough for claim preclusion. This court's precedent in the TMTV case is exactly on point. That was a copyright infringement case where the copyright was asserted based on use of the alleged copyrighted material in a TV program against a producer. And the producer said it should be barred by a prior settlement in a different claim against the broadcaster that broadcast that show. They were both liable for copyright infringement, one having produced the show and one having broadcast the show. And the court said, you can't apply claim preclusion against the producer. Now, you might need to offset damages because this is the same infringing display and you're suing two different people for their part in it. You might need to offset the damages, but you can absolutely bring those claims against both of those parties. You are not precluded, unless there's any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank